We're going to be talking about algorithm analysis today, sometimes referred to as complexity analysis. This is used for determining mathematically whether one program or one algorithm is faster than another. It's also used to basically determine whether an algorithm is reasonable to execute upon a certain amount of data. You may have been introduced to this a little bit in CS 1104 last semester. Basically, if you had two people that wrote two different programs to do the same thing, and you know they got in an argument, and you were claiming that yours is faster than the other person's, how would you go about proving that? Well, you could sort of run them on, but if you ran them on different machines, then you get the fact that maybe one machine's faster, so you'd have to run them on the same machine. But even if you, and then you'd have to run them on the same data, obviously, because one data set might be more complex. But even if you do that, that's not fair. Maybe they were compiled by different compilers. So okay, you say, all right, well we have to compile them on the same compiler. Well, even that's not really fair. Even if you, although you will at times see in some articles execution times reported, where they will report the compiler used and the processor, etc., and the operating system. You don't see that very often, because even if you have two similar programs compiled by the same compiler, executed on the same machine, it might be that the compiler generates slightly more efficient machine code for part of the language than it does for another part of the language, and vice versa for another compiler, and one person's algorithm might be punished because they used part of the language that the compiler is not very good at generating efficient code for. So therefore, you have to basically, in order to do a fair comparison between algorithms, you've got to eliminate all of these things. You can't really compare execution time. What you have to do is you have to go to the language itself, and you basically have to count the number of executed statements in the language in order to determine which of the algorithms is faster than the other. And that's basically what we're going to learn how to do at the moment. Now, here on the next slide, on slide 3, is the rules that we use for counting up the number of executed statements in a high-level language. And you can see here, we don't really care. We aren't going to concern ourselves with the fact that one statement, one very small single statement, might execute slower or faster than a statement of another time, of another type. Like, for example, the time that it would take you to perform an arithmetic assignment statement and calculation, or just an assignment, would be probably a lot less than it would take you to, like, see out a variable's value. But we aren't going to concern ourselves with that. That gets very detailed in terms of the input and output capabilities of the machine, and that is really not something that you can always rely upon, because it's always changing as machines change and different hardware systems change. So we don't worry about the different execution speeds of different statements. We consider, for the purposes of our counting, that all single statements execute at the same speed. Some arbitrary time unit will, when we don't care how much time that is. So the running time of assignment statements, input-output operations, Boolean operations, arithmetic operations, and a function return statement, all of those take time 1 to execute, and we have to count them up. Now, for an if statement or a switch statement, The running time is the time to compute the condition evaluation, to compute the Boolean expression, and plus the maximum of the running times for the individual clauses. For an if statement, it would be you would count up how long it takes the number of statements that executes to do the condition, and then you would, I've got his autograph on that book, by the way. And then it would count. Then you would count up the number of statements in the if part, if it was true, and then the number of statements in the else part. Now, at any given during an execution, only one of those executes, right? So you assume that the larger one will execute, and you add that to the number of statements it takes to compute the if condition. For a loop execution, and this gets a little bit more difficult, it's the time for the loop setup, the initialization, maybe the initial condition evaluation, plus the sum over the number of times that the loop is executed. You have to count up how many times the loop executes, and you sum those over the body time, which is the time all the statements under control of the loop executes, plus the loop check, to check to see if it would, or actually probably should reverse those last two, the update or increment statements that would execute at the end of each loop, and then the loop condition again, the update check. And we always make an assumption that the loop will execute the maximum number of iterations possible. Okay? We don't concern ourselves. We're going to learn in here to do what's called a worst case analysis. And we're always assuming that in the worst case, the data is set up in such a way that it will always cause the maximum number of statements to be executed. That is a little bit easier to do than to do what's called best case analysis and even more complicated an average case analysis, which you need to learn a little bit more calculus before you can do average case analysis. Now, the running time of a function call is time one for the setup to prepare for the function call, plus the time for any parameter calculations and the time for the execution of the function body. Now, and of course we count the return statement in the function as one also. Non-executable statements, declarations, compiler statements, those are not counted. Those do not execute, so we just don't count them. Now here on the next slide is a very simple little nested loop summation.
What's that parameter calculation?
Well, no, in parameters, when you call a function, you can't, if you're passing something by value, you can't have a calculation in there, right? You could say like x plus y. Well, that would be an arithmetic operation, so that would get counted. That's all it means. So here, if we're given these two nested for loops, we apply those rules by rule 4 and 2a. Okay, we have the loop set up, and that's an assignment statement, so that's time one before the loop ever executes for the I equals zero. I less than or n minus one. Now, for loops are pre-test loops, which means the loop gets checked before it ever executes, and then at the end of each execution. Okay, so for pre-test loops, we sort of check the initial we count the initial check separate because that one will always get executed. And then each time the loop executes, it'll get checked again. So we count that first one separately because it always gets executed. So for I less than n minus 1, that would also be part of the setup for the loop. And that's a condition, a less than, plus a subtraction, so that's time 2. So before the loop ever starts, before that outer loop ever starts, we have 3 statements that gets executed. That's where this first 3 comes from. That's where the count of this first 3 comes from. Then we look at that loop. I equals zero while I is less than n minus one. That means that that loop executes for the values from zero to n minus two, right? That loop executes from zero to n minus two. Well now, you don't really want to count starting at zero. Because in math, if you start counting at zero, zero doesn't add to anything. But in terms of the execution of a loop, even if a loop executes with a loop control variable having a value of zero, that should count. So what you do in your analysis is you just shift the loops. Loops that start at zero or even somewhere else, although you don't have to worry about that too much in C, you just shift them so they start at one. So that loop executing from zero to n minus two is the same as counting the number of iterations from one to n minus one. We just add one to both of the end, the beginning and ending values of the loop control variable. Now, so we have to sum that. We have to sum that I loop, which will iterate from one to n minus one number of times. We have to sum that over all of the inner loops. Now, if we look at the inner loop, the J loop, we have J equals zero, J less than I. Well, that's part of the loop setup, the initialization and the initial condition check. That always gets executed. Those are two statements. So that's two of the statements of where this five comes from. You might wonder, where does the other three statements for this five come from? Well, forgetting about the J loop at the moment, when the J loop finishes, what happens for the outer for loop? What happens is we have an increment taking place, that's one, and then we have the condition getting checked again, which is a less than and a subtraction. So that's three more. That's where the other three of this five comes from. We have two statements for the J setup each time that the I loop executes, and we have three statements at the end that gets executed. Everybody follow that? You got to follow this in order to be able to do the exact counts correctly. If you don't, now's a good time to hold up your hand and ask me a question, because otherwise, in a couple weeks when you're sitting in here on the final exam and you're looking at some problem of code that you have to do the computation for, you'll be wondering why you didn't ask me the question now. Okay? All right? All right, you see that the 3 comes in from the I plus plus and the I less than n minus 1, right?
Yes.
Okay, the other 2, each time that for loop executes, the outer for loop executes, the inner for loop at least gets set up, right? And the inner loop, in order for it to get set up, J has to get initialized and the condition has to get checked initially. That's where the other 2 comes from. Okay? Everybody follow this? Huh?
Did we take account for the three already
earlier? We did take account of the three earlier. This three isn't counted each time that the loop executes. This outer three, this is the initial setup. At the end of each loop, the same three, sort of, which is the condition. Actually, this three was from the initialization and the condition. This other three here is from the condition and the increment. Right? Okay. So then we have our inner loop J, which executes from 0 to J less than I. Now that actually iterates for the values from 0 to I minus 1, right? Well, 0 to I minus 1 is the same as going from 1 to I. So that's why we have that inner summation J going from 1 to I. Question?
The I loop has three statements to execute. Like, you don't count the I equals 0.
Well, the I equals 0.
For, like, the initial.
We don't count the I equals 0 inside the summation of the loop, because that only executes one time. right? That's the initialization statement, which only executes one time before the loop begins. Also, before the loop body starts, there is an initial check of the condition. So this three out here is for the initialization and the initial check of the condition to see if the loop should begin executing at all. This five in here, part of that five, once again, is for the condition that gets checked at the end of each loop, of the I loop, plus one for the increment, for the I plus plus. And the other two statements that always get executed here for the I loop is the setup and initialization of the J loop. Okay? So you follow where all this five comes from?
Yes.
Please don't make me say that again. After three times, it should be enough. No, go ahead. I'm joking. Ask me the question.
The five is the J equals zero.
The five is J equals zero, J less than I. That's two statements. And the other three comes from the I plus plus and the I less than N minus 1. The less than is a condition that counts 1 and the subtraction counts 1.
So where's the
J plus plus? It's inside of here. I haven't even gotten to that part yet. Okay? The J plus plus is the increment is executed at the end of the loop. So the increment is always counted inside the sum because it's executed each time. So now we know the J loop goes from 1 to I. How many statements inside the J execute? Well, there's an assignment statement. Array sub ij equals 1. Assignments for time 1. There's no computation there. And then at the end, the J plus plus gets incremented. That's 2. That's an increment. And then the J less than I gets checked again. So that's 3. That's where these three statements, this 3 count inside the J loop comes from. Right? You understand that now? Somebody beside of her helper. Or ask me a question, one of the two. Uh-huh. That the index operators don't count? We don't count those. We just don't count them. Okay? We don't count them. At that point, you're starting to get into offset calculation, assembly language computation. You don't count them, okay? They're considered a memory address with access, which is part of the assignment statements. They're not counted, okay? That's the rules. Okay, if you want to argue about the formation of these rules, you might want to contact Ahol, Hopcroft, and Ullman, which were the first researchers who did this, okay? I believe most of them were up at Carnegie Mellon at one time. Although the person I guess you probably ought to originally contact is Donald Knuth, okay? He's out at Cal Poly Tech, but I'd be a little bit wary about contacting him, okay? That would be an addition and that would count. Right. Okay? Alright. So, everybody see where this formula comes from in terms of the count of the number of executed statements by those rules. Alright? So, what we...
You would have 6 when you do 4 loops.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, if I had statements between the two for loops, that would get executed every time an iteration of the outer loop gets executed, so that would get added here. And if I had other statements inside of the, after the array equals under control of the inner for loop, they would get added here. Okay? I hope all that makes sense. It does to me. Okay. So here's some summation formulas. This is what I showed. I gave a talk in here over the summer to parents of entering freshmen. And I showed them the website, you know, for the course and everything that was available. This was supposed to be the classroom of the 21st century talk that we were giving them. And I played one of the lectures for them, and I brought up some of the notes of the lectures I played, so I brought up this. I brought up this because that way I figured I wouldn't get any questions about it from any of the parents, okay? I brought it up, and immediately they, most of them, cringed, you know. Okay? Alright, so here we have the summation formulas. This is really pretty simple stuff. You can pick this up. If you haven't had discrete math at the moment, don't worry about it. If you have had it, you already know this, or you should. Basically, if you're summing up a function, f of k, and you've got some constant multiplying that function, you can factor out the constant. That's all that rule, F1 summation rule, says. F2 summation rule says that if you're summing up two functions, you can distribute the summation over them separately, and you'll get the same result. The third one says that if you're summing up some constant, some n number of times, it's the constant times n. That should be trivial to you. If you've got the sum of two summed up five times, it's 2 times 5, right? The sum of k, if you're summing up the values from 1 to n, if you're summing up the values from 1 to n, there's the formula for an arithmetic sum from 1 to n. It's n times n plus 1 over 2 is the result if you're summing up the values from 1 to n. There's a famous story in mathematics that says there was this kid by the name of Gauss who was like in the second or third grade, and his teacher told him to sum up the numbers from 1 to 100 to give him something to do, and he walked up in about a minute and said it's 5,050. He basically on his own came up with this formula right here and showed it to her. She probably went, smart kid, back here, never mind. The sum of k, that was a joke, the sum of k squared for F5 is that formula over there. Now, you can look up these formulas, you can look up the proofs. They are accepted facts. They've been proven in mathematics, okay? We can use these, though. If we take the formula from the previous page, we can now use these. We've got a constant. That last summation is just a constant. So 3 summed up I times. Well, that's just 3 times I. We factor out the I. We can factor it out. That's from F3. That's applying F3. Then we can distribute this summation, the I summation, over the 5 and the 3i and factor out the 3 by applying F2 and F1 rules up there. And then we can basically factor out the 5 here, and that's a constant, so that's 5 times n minus 1. And this sum here from 1 to n minus 1 of I, we're summing up the values from 1 to n minus 1. Well, that's almost the same as the values from 1 to n. And all we have to really do in this case is replace the n in that F4 formula with n minus 1. If you replace the n up there with n minus 1 here, you get this. It's n minus 1 times n over 2. And then you plug and chug through the math, and here's the polynomial you come out with. 3 over 2 times n squared plus 7 over 2 times n minus 2. That would be a count of the number of statements that get executed for an arbitrary size of data of size n, okay, for an array of some arbitrary size. That is typical in analysis. When you're doing an algorithm analysis, you assume that the data is of a certain arbitrary size n. And you don't wed it to a particular size, like a thousand, an array of size 1,000 or an array of size 100. You always compute it to be of an arbitrary size. That way, if you really need to, you can always plug in a specific value, but you never really do that. All right, so on the next slide here, on slide 6, doing doing detailed counts of functions can get to be a bit tedious. And what we really want in order to get out of algorithm analysis is sort of an estimate of how much time or how it will take for an algorithm to execute, or basically some idea of how fast an algorithm is compared to maybe some other algorithm. And so one way of doing this is to come up with an estimate of what's called the asymptotic bound, okay? And for our, if we take that function, if we take this function 3n squared plus 5n plus 100, if we break that down into its separate terms and we graph those, we graph the lower two terms, if we graph 5n squared, n squared, and f of n, we get these functions right here. Now, you might wonder, why are we graphing 5n squared? Well, you'll see in a moment. If n is greater than 10, if our input size is greater than 10, then n squared will be greater than 100, okay? If n is greater than 5, then n squared is greater than 5n. If 5n, of course, would be 25, and 5 squared would be 25, and then 6n would be 30, but 6 squared would be 36, so it always stays larger at that point. Therefore, if n is greater than 10, we can say this function up here, 3n squared, 5n plus 100, will always be less than this other function, 3n squared plus n squared plus n squared, which is 5n squared. It will always be less than that once n grows to be greater than or equal to 10. Now, this is a property of function, of polynomial functions. That means that 5n squared basically forms what's called an upper bound of f of n, an asymptotic upper bound, actually. In other words, f of n doesn't grow any faster than its asymptotic bound in the long run. And that 5n squared, of course, is a simpler function than the original function. Now, we use that to basically state what an estimate for the complexity of an algorithm. It's usually called the big O notation. Just because the guys who originally did this chose the omega symbol to represent this function. They defined it formally like this. They say that if you've got two functions, f of n and g of n, functions of n, we can say that f of n is in the order of g of n, provided that there are some constants, c greater than 0 and some capital N greater than 0, such that for all small n that's greater than this constant of n, f of n will always be less than or equal to this constant times g of n. Sometimes we'll say that f is big O of g, or f is n order of g. By the definition above, we just demonstrated that function f is in the order of n squared. Why? Well, because we found these constants, c and n, which in this case for us was 5 and 10, which we just showed that inequality holds. And so by this definition, then we can say this function f of n, which was always less than or equal to 5n squared when n was greater than 10, it's in the order n squared. It's an n squared ordered algorithm. That's all this allows us to say. Nothing real complicated. Now, actually, we could also say that since 5n squared is less than or equal to 9n squared, we could conclude that f of n is also in the order of 9n squared. But we're interested in the tightest or smallest upper bound. So we prefer 5n squared to 9n squared. Now, this gives rise to what's called some big O theorems, and these have all been proven. If you take a course in algorithm analysis at the senior level, you might actually look at some of the proofs for these theorems. Some of the proofs are quite trivial. If we've got a function f of n of n and k is some constant, we can say that any constant, any plain constant, non-function really, is of order 1. That falls out of that definition of the big O notation, of the big O definition. A polynomial is the order of the term containing the highest power of n. Now, that has to be proven, but we essentially almost just sort of proved that, at least for one specific instance just a second ago. K times f of n is of order f of n, the constant coefficients we just draw. And in general, we can say that f of n is the big O, the order of the dominant term of f of n, where the dominant term gets determined by the following list. Whatever the dominant term is, whichever is the largest of these things, constants, the log base of some n, we always assume log base 2 if no base is shown, n log n squared, n to higher powers, 2 to the nth, 3 of n, we get into geometric terms at this point, larger constants to the nth power, n factorial, and n to the nth, okay? It turns out that there's also a theorem that says for any base b, the log base b of n is the order of log n, where log base 2 of n. You can prove that. That's a little trickier to prove. So, what does this mean for us? Well, here on slide 9, if we graph out these complexity classes from the previous slide, if we graph those, okay, look here, we've got log n, so down here very near the bottom, log n, n log n's a little bit above that one, then we have n squared, n cubed, 2 to the nth, 10 raised to the nth power, okay, and n is going. This is the plot for these curves as n goes from zero base or one, zero up to 10 or 11 for some of them. Basically, what we can notice if you look at the growth rates of these curves, this is basically if an algorithm. If we do the analysis, we count up the number of executable statements of an algorithm. And then we compute up its order. We apply the big O notation to compute up what order, what complexity class that algorithm falls in. And that's not real complicated. It certainly is not going to be in this class. We're not going to do any real complicated stuff here. If we do that and we look at these growth curves, look at the number of statements here. The left part of this graph, basically the y-axis over there, which represents the number of statements that would get executed for an algorithm in this complexity class that falls into one of these complexity classes. Well, you can notice here, look at that, for size n, for 10, for a very small data set of size 10, some of those functions are already up to 1,000 statements that have to get executed. And they're shooting up at a tremendous rate. Basically, what this tells us is that algorithms that are of order greater than n squared require far more time than algorithms of order n squared or less, even for very small input sizes. And for very small values of n, there's really not much practical difference between the order n squared and order log n. Question?
Remember the third cell?
Say that?
The
10 to the 3rd? That's, you mean 10 cubed? 10 cubed, 10 times 10 is 100, times 10 is 1,000. Well, isn't that? Oh, they've got 3 down there. Yeah, that should be that should be pushed back 1. They've obviously got that off on the graph. Okay. Yeah, I don't know what he used to graph that with. I didn't graph that. I'll blame that on McLean. Whenever there's mistakes in the notes, whichever one of us is lecturing, we always blame the other one. If we look at these low order curves, if we graph just the low order curves, the n squared, n log n, and log n, even for small input sizes, if you look at this, n squared algorithms will start to require a lot more time than order n log n. Okay. The what's called the constants of proportionality. That's the coefficients in the polynomial that describe the polynomial function that we arrive at once we have done a complexity analysis and we've summed up everything. We will come up with some function, some polynomial function. The lower order terms of that function, not the dominant term, but the lower order terms and all the coefficients really have almost no effect for large values of n. For large values of n, the dominant term basically determines the vast majority of the number of executed statements. And that's really why this big O notation arose, because the researchers discovered that. For one thing that you should get out of at least these last couple of slides and discussion is that for large problems with an order greater than n log n, you can't really execute them. It'll take too long. For n of about 1,000 medium problems, n squared algorithms can still be used today. 20 years ago, that didn't used to be true. 20 years ago, well, maybe 15 years ago. 15 years ago, that still wasn't true. Back around, I guess, the mid-80s, I had just graduated out of here. I was bowling at the time in a bowling alley. I used to average 200. The guy who was the, I'm not joking, the guy who was the league secretary, Tom Shrewsbury, called me over and said, "Hey, my kid wrote this program for me to basically do all of the statistics for all the bowlers here. And it's working fine, except I've got to prepare a report every few months for the American Bowling Congress to give them all the statistics for all of the bowlers." There were several thousand bowlers in this establishment. And he said, "Something's wrong with the code that my kid wrote, because we started the program last night to print this out, and we shut the machine off this morning because it's not working." And so I brought his kid over there, and I went, "Hey, what sorting algorithm did you use?" And of course he went, "Algorithm? What's an algorithm?" All right, so I talked to him about how he did the sorting, because he had to sort everything. Well, he used an inefficient sorting algorithm, an n-squared sorting algorithm. There was nothing wrong with it. His code was right. If they had left the thing, if they'd left that little Commodore C64, which worked all night, you know, that little 8-bit processor in there was probably working its heart out trying to sort these thousands of records. If they'd left the thing run for several days, it would have worked. But they would have had to leave it running for several days. So I took out a pencil and a piece of paper and I said, here's what you want. And I wrote him out an n log n sort. And I said, "Go home and type this in and come back and tell me what happened." And next week when I was there, he said, "Well, that worked in about 20 minutes. And I went, "I knew that." And that's the difference. That's the difference in algorithms. His algorithm would have worked. It was perfect. There was nothing logically wrong with it. The problem was it just took too long. On the same machine, a different algorithm, a much better algorithm, cut the time down dramatically. And so you should be aware of that now. When you're coding up problems, if you think you've got some complex code and it might get executed on a fairly large amount of data, 2,000, 1,000, several thousand records, you better do a complexity analysis and look at it and determine whether it's going to be reasonable to do so, because your users could be using your program, and if you don't realize this, they might ask your program to do something, and then they're suddenly sitting there and your program's not doing a thing. And they wait for several minutes and it still doesn't do anything. They wait for 10 minutes and it doesn't do anything, and they figure what? Your program's crashed. So what do? They bring up the task manager and they kill it. Quite possible your program hasn't crashed. What's your program doing? It's working its heart out trying to do this algorithm. It's an inefficient algorithm that you've coded up for it. Okay? So what you have to do in that case is what? You have to let the user know ahead of time. Hey, you're asking me to do this. Be patient. It's going to take a few minutes. Don't kill me before I get it done. Uh-huh.
So what you're saying is that you're going to be using monkey sorting.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, you shouldn't be using it. It's a piece of crap. We will look at an n log n sorting algorithm next week, okay? And you will start using it for anything that you have to sort of any reasonable size, unless you're foolish and you don't gain anything from these discussions. Here on slide 11, we've got those two, we've got that little section of code that we just analyzed. We were given that total time complexity there, and we can say, okay, by theorem 2, that is the order of 3 over 2 times n squared of the dominant term, and then by theorem 3, we can throw out the constant and say that is of order n squared. So we'd say that given code fragment is of order n squared complexity. Now, this actually, in order to arrive at that statement, involves some work that we really don't need to do. The big O analysis basically gives us a gross indication of the overall complexity of an algorithm. And we can obtain that without actually doing an exact count of every statement. And we'll arrive at the same conclusion. So, here on slide 1212 is the modified analysis rules, so that we don't have to bother to count everything. For the running time of each of the following statements times t of 1, omitting the arithmetic operators. We don't bother to count up the individual arithmetic operators. And we don't bother to count up individual Boolean operations. Notice statement C says Boolean condition evaluation. It doesn't say, it's not each of the operators and conditional or inequality operators. We don't count those up now. The running time of a selection is time t1 to the condition plus the maximum of the individual clauses. That's a slight change. The loop count doesn't change at all, except we're affected by these other rules. The running time for a function call is time 1 for the setup. We don't bother to worry about the computations of any of the parameters inside of a call to a function. And the new rule, rule 6, the running time of a sequence of statements is the largest time of any statement in the sequence. Now that means if I count up several different sequences, to gain an exact analysis, I'd have to add them all together. But I'm not looking for an exact analysis. I'm looking for the big O order. And I can basically look at the separate sequences and take the largest of them. And that gives me the big O. Now in order to prove all of this, would take me quite a bit of time, and I'm not going to do it. Most of we don't have we you for most of you, unfortunately, you haven't had enough of computability theory to understand the proofs at this point. But you take the algorithm analysis classes, you take a computability class, and you can learn those.
The theory of computing class, that's the algorithm.
Yep, the theory of computing. Now, wait a minute, that's a 4,000 level course, yes.
Uh-huh.
Make sure you check the prerequisites.
Math.
Okay. Make sure you check the prerequisites. You're going to have a problem if you take that because they're going to be referring to a lot of algorithms that you may not have studied yet in terms of algorithms that are covered in data structures course and the operating systems course. But you decide that on your own. All right. So let's look at another example here on slide 13. We've got the sum I to n for this array. Now, this is a weird array summation. What this array sums is, you can see we've got this outer loop going from 0 to n, and then the inner for loop goes from j starting at 0 to I, and it sums up those values at the starting of the array. Initially, it just sums up the first one. Then it adds the first one to the second one, and it replaces the second one with the sum of the first two. Then it sums up the next three. It sums up the first one, the sum of the first two, and the third one, and it puts that sum in the third one. And then it does the same thing for the fourth one. It adds up the first one, the sum of the first two, the sum of the first three, and the fourth one, and it sticks that in the fourth. It's doing a weird summation. Probably not a useful summation, except for the purposes of demonstration here. You need to know a lot of times, it's very helpful, don't try to analyze code without knowing what it's doing. Right? That will just get you confused. You can't always apply these rules sort of blindly without understanding what the code is trying to do. Okay? So we know what this code's trying to do. I've labeled in the right column here with letters the executable statements so that we can refer to those statements A through H. Now, our analysis will deal with those A through H executable statements. Let's look at the inner loop. We'll look at the inner loop sum from 0 to I. That's the same, going from 0 to I, the J loop, that's the same as going from I to I plus 1. So we just shift that 1. But the body of the loop, we've got an assignment and an increment in there. That's the maximum of, by rule 6, which is the maximum of the sequence of statements, which is the larger? Well, it doesn't really matter. They're both of order 1. The loop condition, by rule 2, the loop condition E and F take time 1, so the sum of the inner body loop takes time 1. All of those statements inside of the loop is 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1. They get executed each time, so it's just order 1 for the sequence, because we aren't worried about an exact analysis. We're really just worried about the number of times the loop executes is what that theorem really tells us. So, the order of that inner loop, which goes from I to I plus 1 of 1, is just order I, because I will be larger than 1. Now, the outer loop, we sum that goes from 0 to n. Well, that's the same starting our counting at 1 from 1 to n plus 1. By rule 6 again, it's the maximum of the loop condition statement C, okay, which is actually two assignment statements, the inner loop G and H. All of those statements are inside the body of the outer loop, so by rule 6, it's the maximum of each of those sequences. Well, the loop condition C, G, and H each takes time 1. So the outer loop body takes time order 1. That should be order 1. That should be order I, because I will be greater than, there's a mistake there in the notes. That should be an I. I must have got typed wrong. Or is it an I? It is, but as you can see from the sink and the slate. Whatever. It should be I, okay? Because I will be, each of these are one. The inner loop, which is C, which is I, is going to be larger than one, so that's I. So we really have the order of this, of the outer loop, as I equals 1 to N plus 1 of I. And we know by those summation rules that we went through earlier, that's N plus 1 times N plus 2 over 2. We compute all of that out, we apply our order rules, and that's of order N squared. And then by rule 6, the big O complexity of the entire function would be the maximum of the outer loop and statement 1, okay, which is of order 1. So the entire function is of order N squared. Really, what this tells you, when you're computing the complexity, if you understand what the code's doing, and you can always be assured that for different values of n, the loops will always be executing, you know, their maximum time. They won't be stopping short because of some funky data or whatever. And certainly in this case for array data, what the contents of the array doesn't affect the summation at all. What you need to do then is to sum up the loops. You need to sum up the loops. And that'll give you your order of the entire algorithm. It's the loops is where programs spend all of their time.
Okay. Would it be order n
if the loops were not nested, and we had the same sort of two loops, although we'd have to obviously modify the inner one. As long as the inner one didn't go any larger than n either, right? The order is, it would really be order 2n, but we throw away the 2, it would be order n.
Okay, so you go the loop
with
the most nested loop.
Okay. That's right, yep. But now, of course, what about recursion? Well, we aren't going to do any analysis of recursive functions. But recursion is really just like a loop, right? It's the looping takes place by the recursive calls. You'll learn some math in the discrete math and stuff with summing up recursive functions, recurrence relations in order to, you'll learn what you need to learn in order to do that. Yeah. Here on slide 14 is the exact count of that function. Okay? Here's the exact count, which once you work it all out, comes out to be 2n squared plus 15n plus 2. Now, I'm going to let you guys work that one out on your own. Okay? This is applying not those order analysis rules, but the time analysis rules to get an exact count of the total number of executed statements by those first set of rules that we looked at. Yes, you will. You will be tested on both. You won't need to worry about that because I won't give you any, on the test, I won't give you any class code to sort of analyze, okay? But if so, yes, you would have to take that into account, and that operation would actually be a call to the function. So you have to go out and compute the order of the function and add that in to the computation of that statement that the operator occurred in, if you were actually going to do it. Okay? But I'm not going to get that tricky. Okay?
Well, the same thing applies like if you have like a large structure by value instead of reference, you'd have to.
No, the execution, those execution rules don't pertain to space. And they also don't pertain then to the amount of time that it would take for the memory copying to go on. Okay? That's just not done, because that gets too sort of language design specific, and the rules just get too complex when we have to start considering things like that. Okay.
If you had no loops,
no function calls, just a bunch of computations and output statements, one right after another, and even maybe if statements and switch statements. By the order, that would be order one. Even though in reality we know exactly it wouldn't be, obviously. Now, what? Don't get into the thinking of, oh, okay, that means then that I can replace each loop by a copy of the statements that would cause each iteration, and therefore I'd end up with order one. In reality, you know that wouldn't be the case, right?
Right. Now, if you had function calls, you know, and a loop and a function, would still be one?
Yep. That's exactly what all those rules tell you. So, what does this tell us in terms of our practical application to programming? Well, if we assume that there's 100,000 seconds in a day, there's actually only 86,400. But we'll say there's 100,000. We'll give the computer some extra time to do its work. That's about 10 to the 5th seconds. If we have an input size of 1 million, some data of 1 million items, that's not that big, okay? Let's say we have a computer that executes 1 million instructions per second. Now, you might think that's not a very fast computer by today's standards. But we're talking about 1 million C++ statements a second, okay? Not these little machine code statements, which is what the manufacturers of the processors count. We're talking C++ statements. This is still a fairly powerful, that would still be a fairly powerful processor if it could execute 1 million C++ statements a second. If we do a comparison then, of an order n squared and n log n algorithm, look at the difference. The order n squared, n would be 10 to the 6th, so that's 10 to the 6th squared instructions to execute, or 10 to the 12th instructions. If it can execute, it has 10 to the 6th, if it can execute 1 million statements a second, then it would be 10 to the 12th over 10 to the 6th seconds required to run it, which is 10 to the 6th. And if we divide that by 10 to the 5th, the number of seconds in a day, which is larger than it really is, we come up with 10 days. It would take 10 days to run an n squared algorithm with 1 million pieces of data. But if we have an algorithm that does the same thing, but it's of order n log n, look at what it takes. It takes 20 seconds to run. 20 seconds compared to 10 days. Basically, that tells you just what, I mean, hopefully that drives the point home of what we stated earlier, where we mentioned that if for large values of n squared algorithms or larger aren't practical to execute. They take far too long. Now, there are some problems where those are the only algorithms people know. Are these inefficient n squared or larger algorithms? And sometimes they have to be run. But whatever happens, you know, you've got to basically take that into account. For example, you might wonder why. Most of you aren't old enough, but over the last 20 or 30 years, weather reporting has gotten quite a bit better. And a lot of people think that it's gotten better because of the satellites. And that certainly has a part to play in it. But it has also gotten better because the simulations that they run out of the National Weather Service, they used to run them out of Boulder, Colorado. They used to run them at the time on supercomputers, which they still do today. But even 10 or 20 years ago, the supercomputers at that time were just not that fast. And they had to make a lot of, they couldn't run, it would take them hours and hours to run the program to predict the next day's computer for the, or the next day's weather for the continental U.S. Obviously, if they had added in, the math was known. The math was known to make the simulation 10 or 20 years ago. The math had already been developed to make the simulation better than it was and to make it more accurate. The problem was it took greater than 24 hours to run. Now, if they had added in all of the math that they knew at that time, or most of it, to get a more accurate prediction model in the simulation, it would have been ridiculous because the weatherman would have been standing up Saturday going, our predictor shows that yesterday's weather would have been, okay, would have done them no good. So they basically had to take shortcuts and they had to leave out a lot of the computations. They just couldn't add them in because the machines were not fast enough to do them. Nowadays, the machines have gotten quite a bit faster and they've added in quite a bit more of the computations. They can still get more accurate, they can add in some more factors, but they're going to have to wait once again as the machines get faster and faster. So all of this comes into play with a lot of things that we do. Don't worry when you're doing a complexity analysis, you're comparing two algorithms. If they're in the same complexity class, if you've got two n-squared algorithms, for example, bubble sort and selection sort, both of those are n-squared algorithms. They're of order n-squared. Bubble sort is about twice as slow as selection sort. Does that matter in terms of large values of n? What does it matter whether one takes 10 days and the other one takes 20 days? As far as we're concerned, it's still too crapping long, okay? It makes no difference at that point. The fact that one's twice as slow as the other one, because for all practical purposes, it's worthless. So you've got to realize that. Is hardware getting faster going to mean that all of this algorithm complexity class that, analysis that we learn, we can eventually forget, and later on, you know, in 20 years or so, as other students are sitting in this class, and God, I might still be here teaching it. I don't even want to think about that. Does that mean that I won't be teaching this stuff in 10 or 20 years' time? Well, let's say we've got a machine that was capable of executing 10 times as many instructions, roughly 10 times faster. A machine that would execute 10 million C++ statements a second. Whew, I wouldn't mind having that machine on my desktop. Does it really matter? Not really. N squared, a million pieces of data, instead of taking 10 days, I now have to wait 24 hours. Now I'm not willing to wait that long. Okay? Maybe for a very important problem I am, but I, who wants to wait that long unless they really have to? The problem better be darn important. That's still one day versus 20 seconds if an order n log n algorithm was used on the slower machine. On the machine that was 10 times slower, the n log n algorithm would still beat the pants off the other one. So be aware that the 100 times faster, 2.4 hours compared to 20 seconds again on the slower machine. The algorithms that we use will affect the and be affecting the processors for years to come. For years and years to come. There are a lot of problems nowadays that we can't really practically solve We can solve them, but we can't practically solve them because nobody's come up with an algorithm that's efficient enough to solve them. Back years and years ago, the chess programs, which I had an interest in and learned how to program up, because I played quite a bit of chess, as I told you, the algorithms that they used were just not fast enough. The algorithms weren't fast enough, the machines weren't fast enough. 20 years ago, I could beat any computer in the world, and was doing it, because they were jokes. And I was only playing at the expert level. Nowadays, of course, the algorithms, not only is it the fact that we have all these special processors, and that the processors have speeded up by 10 or 20 times, it's not only that that the chess plan, it's not really that that sparked the major breakthrough in chess programs. The major breakthrough came from people coming up with different algorithms to compute their next move so that they could do it efficiently on these really fast machines. And unfortunately, that research has panned out so well that now I can't even beat the computer sitting in my house most of the time. Okay? Alright, that's it. We're going to start talking about sorting on Tuesday. Get your programs done.